Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing abortion provider Amy Hagstrom-Miller about her work, particularly in the light of the recent assassination of Dr. George Tiller. Also, why Will Salatin and Steve Waldman talking abortion get it all wrong, and why pro-choicers should feel okay about the Governor Sanford spectacle. Mary Roach fans rejoice. She's putting more video content out there. Here's her talking about how to have a better sex life.
The one sexual therapy technique that seemed to be, that worked well for women and seemed to be pretty simple was like mindfulness training. It's just all about not spectating, not watching yourself, being in the moment and not being anxious about what's expected of you, or are you reacting right, or is your partner reacting right? But that's, you know, easier said than done. You know, it's like somebody telling you, relax.
I'm currently reading her book Stiff, which is about the various things that happen to corpses. The sex stuff is usually a little easier to read about.
Hi, I'm Will Salatin from Slate Magazine.
And I'm Steve Waldman from Leafen.
We're a couple of guys who were, this will be the even more politically incorrect version of Two Girls, One Cup. This will be two men, no uteruses, and we're going to be talking about abortion and common ground and compromise and all the conversation that's going on in and around the web.
Jody Jacobson wrote about it, but I can't help myself. I have to play some clips from this train wreck of a conversation between two men who will never be pregnant, doing that thing they do, where they rotate between being mildly annoying to making me reach for a butter knife to pop out my eardrums rather than listen to their blather. I watched it so you don't have to, and you'll be privy to some of the more outrageous things that Salatin and Waldman said. Waldman kicks off with a doozy of a statement.
In a way, disentangling of conservative views about contraception from their views about abortion. Maybe that's as good a place as any to start, because in a way what I was actually advocating was that pro-life people be more single-minded, be more single-issue than they have been. I know that they are usually get the rep of being too single-issue oriented, but in a way it's that they're not enough, because a lot of the opposition to contraception and birth control is for reasons that are philosophical, theological, not actually related to their views on abortion.
I'm going to be charitable and chalk this up to wishful thinking instead of outright deceit. Anti-choicers openly link contraception and abortion, and even though they claim their opposition to both has something to do with life, it's clear that the more obvious connection is that both have to do with sex. Specifically, the problem is, and always has been, the fear that women who don't risk childbirth every time they have sex will have an opportunity to escape male control. Waldman's statement here shows why I think this common ground strategy is doomed to failure. If you can't accept the basic reality that the anti-abortion position is grounded in hostility to sexual liberation and women's rights, then you really can't have a productive conversation. While Waldman shoots out more "are you kidding me" statements than Salatin, Salatin does a bang-up job of keeping up with the nonsense.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the role of morality, how pro-choice people, we've just been talking about pro-life people and their problem with contraception and how they sort of need to get over it, at least that's my view of it, but what about pro-choice people and morality and the way that they, or morality or, and let's throw in religion, do pro-choice people need to get over their aversion to either believing in or just using the words morality and religion?
Okay, fine. I'm happy to use the word morality. I think it's immoral for people with hang-ups about sex and fantasies of a 1950s patriarchy to advocate for immoral laws banning women's right to make their own moral choices about abortion and birth control. I think it's immoral to use the word morality to mean not being a slut. I think morality is how you treat people and act in the world, not who you sleep with or whether or not you have a baby when some stranger thinks you should. In fact, I think that women choose abortion and contraception for intensely moral reasons most of the time. Because it's moral to want to only have children when you're ready. It's moral to cherish your own health and well-being enough that you are responsible in your sexual behavior. It's moral to believe that women are human beings who deserve not just the right to bodily autonomy, but to finish their educations, marry who they want, and have the right to determine their own lives. I think it's immoral to stop them. I think it's morally suspect to obsess over the fact that some woman somewhere got away with having unapproved sex. I think that people who scream at women trying to get reproductive health care are not only not the moral standard, but have a distinct lack of morals and a sadistic streak. Is that enough moral talk, or should I apologize for having sex instead? There's over 60 minutes of this kind of talk, and mostly it's not productive. They dwell on the idea that contraception is common ground, when in reality, pro-choicers and not pro-lifers have always advocated it. Nothing new there. But I can't finish this off without exposing you to a quote from Waldman that really drives home to me that no matter how much he writes about this issue, he doesn't really think about it. He just reacts based on a bunch of reactionary feelings. This is his reaction to Salatin wisely pointing out that most women don't want to carry a baby for 9 months just to give it up for adoption.
Financial incentives or help for women who decide to carry a baby to term. I mean, you look at it even in economic terms. Someone is 3 months pregnant, you're saying, go another 6 months and then give birth. Well, they're going to be have to, you know, maybe drop out of school or drop out of the job. They're making a real economic sacrifice as well as a health risk. So maybe we ought to be saying to them, if it's sufficiently important for us as a society to reduce the number of abortions, maybe we should pay her $1,000, or I don't know what the right number is, because you don't want to then create a financial incentive for, you know, making babies.
And that's basically the entire tone of this discussion, and many like it. There's all these noises being made of understanding what it must be like, and then solutions are offered that show that they don't actually know or apparently care to know. How low must your opinion of unmarried pregnant women be to say that they would be bought over with what amounts to 14 cents an hour for the work of making a baby? Waldman admits that the push to get more women to give up babies is symbolic. But he should think harder about that because it shows what symbolically matters to anti-choicers. Adoption symbolizes a return to the proper social order, where bad, slutty women give up their babies to deserving married couples. If you think it's a crime when unmarried women have sex, this is the way for them to pay back their debt to society. The common ground discussion will be doomed to fail as long as the misogyny and sex phobia that drives the anti-choice movement is pointedly ignored like this. I'd like to welcome Amy Hagstrom Miller to the program. Amy is the founder of Whole Women's Health in Austin, Texas, where she provides abortions along with other gynecological services, and she's here today to talk about her work and the challenges abortion providers face, especially in the light of this resurgence of domestic terrorism. Welcome to RealityCast, Amy.
Thank you.
When we were first talking about this interview, it was before the horrible murder of Dr. George Tiller, and I know things have been chaotic for you since then. How have you been coping?
You know, it's been a really challenging time. I knew Dr. Tiller personally. He was somebody I would consider a hero and a mentor, and he was one of the most sort of profoundly deep abortion providers I'd ever met. The service he provided, of course, was like, you know, one of the most complex and difficult, both medically and emotionally and spiritually, kinds of abortions that are provided in the country. And I think, you know, in order to be able to do that, one needs to be, really a deep and sort of evolved person. And so, you know, I think you've probably heard from many people in these last few days about his medical practice and the long-term harassment he endured and previous assassination attempts he survived. And for me, some of the most profound lessons I learned from George were about how he would talk about ministering to the heart of a woman. And he understood that abortion isn't just about science, it's not just about religion, but it's about the heart of a woman and her examination of who she wants to be and what she believes and what her life might hold for her. And so that part of it has been part of where my grief comes from, is that not only are we in trouble in a way to figure out how we're going to replace the medical care that he provided, but also the way in which he provided it, integrating, you know, the whole person into the difficulty of the abortions that he provided. So that part of it's a challenge. I think also the other piece of it that's really been challenging for me has been just, you know, that we all offer a safe place for women, you know, especially here in my office, where we oftentimes talk about how we're an oasis from the stigma surrounding abortion in our culture and from the voices and the judgments that others often make. We give an opportunity for people to sit quietly and contemplate. And, you know, it's hard if, you know, let's face it, a high-profile physician with a bulletproof vest is ushering in his church, and if he can be murdered in broad daylight, there's not much anybody can do or say to remain completely safe in our society. You know, our society is tolerating this brutality, and it's coming from a movement that calls itself pro-life. And I think this movement really uses words that incite and inflame. And so it's not really a surprise that this anger bubbles up in our society. And, you know, I think one of the parts of the reality that a lot of us who've provided abortion care for a long time, we've gotten sort of used to it in some ways, not used to the brutality of a murder, but used to this ongoing day-to-day culture of terror where we're followed and we're bullied and we're yelled at and we're challenged and we're, you know, it's just kind of nip, 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 nip all the time. And I'm scared sometimes for this country of intolerance, and that the hatred is tolerated and it's given, you know, media minutes under the guise of free speech. So it's made a lot of us, and me especially, really think deeply about this culture where, you know, we tolerate calling doctors and women murderers. We scream hateful slurs and horrible names at people, threatening their lives, threatening, you know, their livelihood. You know, there's a fine line between bullying and free speech and language that fans the flame of violence. And so I look at it not only as, you know, I think one of the things I've been talking about lately is that it's not just about abortion providers. Sometimes abortion providers are seen as this, what I like to call the radical fringe of the pro-choice movement, you know, because we actually provide the service and we talk about abortion and we sit with women all the time. And so, you know, we use the language that women use, and sometimes it makes sort of, you know, abortion on demand, no apologies kind of wings of the pro-choice movement uncomfortable, because, we understand that, you know, no woman comes into my clinic and says, I'd like to exercise my civil right to have an abortion. You know, that's not how women experience an abortion. And I think those of us who actually provide the service really understand the complexity and the emotions that are involved. And we have room for that ambiguity. We have room for that examination of identity that oftentimes goes along with abortion for many women. And oftentimes I think, you know, that these anti-abortion people aren't protesting me. They're not protesting the abortion provider. They're actually protesting the women who have abortions. Women have always had abortions. And, you know, that's actually who they're opposing. And so I sometimes think that we abortion providers get targeted, but really if we stepped out of the way, what would it take for, you know, a conservative estimate is 45 million women have had abortion in this country since Roe. And so what does it take to keep 45 million women silent? You have to spend, you know, millions of dollars to shame them and to tell them that they're murderers over and over and over again until they almost believe it themselves. And what would it look like if all of the people who have had abortions in our country, or people who have supported or loved somebody who's had an abortion, talked about abortion without that stigma and shame? you know, then you wouldn't have providers kind of standing up, providing this service as though nobody has abortions, when actually in our culture, I think the current statistic is 38% of women will have an abortion by the age of 45. Yet it has an enormous amount of stigma still associated with it.
Let's talk some about, as somebody who is basically, I think, for a lot of pro-choice activists who listen to this podcast, we see abortion providers as kind of on the front lines. And yeah, it looks a little different in there. And there is that diversity of reactions that women have to their experience of abortion. How do you handle that? I mean, there's just so much diversity.
Yeah. You know, I actually love the diversity of reactions in abortion. And that's kind of what drew me to the work, is that, you know, my passion to provide an individualized care experience for somebody as they examine what they want to do about an unplanned pregnancy. You know, I kind of back it up to the fact that people have an unplanned pregnancy and that they have a few different choices of how they want to deal with that unplanned pregnancy. And abortion is one of the options that they might choose. And, you know, people oftentimes either ask me or don't ask me, but I know that this is the question that's underlying. They look at me and they say, why abortion? You know, why do you do this work? And for me, abortion care is almost a calling. One of the ways that I really connected with Dr. Tiller was that he used to refer to his work as reproductive ministry. And to me, abortion involves all the big things in life. And the ambiguity that some people have, or the sort of examination that they have in their decision-making process, to me, is the thing. That is the abortion experience to me. The actual medical procedure to me sometimes is just like one step in the process. But to me, the compelling part of working in abortion is that it involves all the big things in life: sex, life, death, religion, family. And abortion gives me the opportunity to have a heart-to-heart conversation about these things, about what really matters to women every single day of my life. I get to sit with a woman as she examines what she believes. And as she looks at what matters most to her, what are her intentions, what are her dreams. And for a lot of women that I've seen, abortion is kind of like a rite of passage. It's often one of the first times where women take a look at the values they've inherited from their culture, from their family, or from their church, and they decide which ones are applicable or meaningful to them and which ones aren't. And so whether or not a woman has an abortion where she's like, woohoo, I'm so happy I'm not pregnant anymore, or if she has, you know, it takes her a long time to decide, or she chooses to continue the pregnancy, to me, that examination and that making of a decision around abortion is a time when a woman acts with intention. And when she chooses the path for her life and the direction she will travel. And part of what I'm signed up for is to really notice that moment of acting with intention and hold it up high for the woman to notice and for her to feel it and own it as her own, and to invite her to experience her whole life as though she was in charge of it. And that sounds kind of funny because people are like, well, of course you're in charge of your own life. But I think a lot of people don't experience life that way. And I think in our culture, people like to pretend that abortions kind of happen to people. And I think for women especially, there are many times in our lives where life kind of happens to us, where we don't feel like we get to stand up and say, this is what I want, or this is where I want to go. And abortion really stands out as a time when I can support a woman to be the actor in her own life, to be the chooser, not to be a victim, but to be intentional and deliberate and ethical in choosing what's best for her. So to me, the outcome is sort of less important than the examination. And then the second part of my answer to that question, why abortion? Because sometimes I get it from people who know me really well, is, you know, they're like, how did you end up here? You know, and for me, it's that sitting with a woman as she examines her abortion decision provides me with an opportunity to plant seeds, inviting her to look at her life differently than she may have before she came into my clinic. I have a moment to affirm that she's a good person, to affirm that she's moral and that she's kind, to affirm that she's not selfish. I can be a witness to her dreams and her desires and gently nudge her to affirm that she's put on this earth to seek them out and not just receive the lot that might be dealt to her. So I have an opportunity to kind of shine some light on her situation and turn on a light bulb, for lack of a better analogy, or two in her own thinking, especially about what's possible, what she's capable of. I get an opportunity to kind of invite her to accept herself and live out her dreams. And this is sort of a byproduct of abortion care to some people. But to me, it is abortion care. I've been known to say abortion is the hole in the donut, you know, like, and that really all the things around the actual medical procedure are what makes working in this field so profound, that I can truly make a contribution that matters. That by sitting with a woman as she examines what matters most to her, I can truly change the world one woman at a time by listening to her story, by witnessing her experience, and like I said, kind of gently nudging her to be all that she can be.
I get the impression that from reading some abortion providers' accounts that they started off just figuring that's a service you provide as a gynecologist, and that if you're pro-choice, you should. Do you feel that if you come from it from that approach that you kind of end up where you're at mentally about this, or have you seen a lot of different opinions on that?
You know, it's kind of an examination of the come from piece of it. You know, whether you're a physician or whether you're a counselor or whether you're an administrator or a clinic owner, I mean, all of us sort of end up in abortion care for different reasons. You know, I like to say, you know, it's not like something you can major in college. You know, you can't say, I want to be an abortion provider. I think that there is kind of a movement right now in the medical students for choice community where a lot of people are specifically going to medical school because they want to be an abortion provider. My background is in international relations and women's studies and religious studies. And so one of the reasons I got into the field was because of this sort of, you know, ethical, moral kind of examination about, you know, what do I want to do with my life? Who do I want to be? Which is what was compelling to me. And then the medicine kind of happened to me, you know, like I had to learn all this stuff about medicine. And then in turn, later, I had to learn all this stuff about management and business and how to run an efficient operation so that we are able to have the majority of ourselves available to the women we serve. And so kind of as a byproduct, I learned everything I could about medicine, you know, ended up doing every job in the clinic before I went out on my own and decided to purchase a clinic. And in that time frame, became really good at sort of medical technician stuff, but then also became really practiced at business, for lack of a better description, you know, how to run a really great organization, leaving the majority of our resources for the women who serve the patients on a daily basis. So that, you know, I'm kind of a systems thinker, you know. I make sure our computer systems work really well and our front office systems work really well and our phones work really well so that my staff can have all the tools that they need to be able to be completely present and available to the women who come into our office. And, you know, a lot of people in the movement that I've talked to sort of ended up in abortion care and then, you know, learned about medicine, or if they're physicians, they came into medicine and then they get this byproduct in abortion care where they're thanked. Doctors say this all the time. People thank me for doing abortions more than I get thanked for any other thing I ever do in my medical career. And it's a very intense, deep and meaningful relationship that the physicians get to have with the women they serve in abortion care as well, which people don't necessarily think about.
Whole Women's Health has a website at wholewomenshealth.com where you can see their pages for their Austin, Baltimore, Beaumont, and McAllen locations. Thank you for coming on to RealityCast, Amy.
Oh, you're welcome. And I just want to point out that I'm very involved in an organization called the Abortion Care Network, and we have an effort called Enough Basta, you know, Basta means enough in Spanish, that is about stopping sidewalk bullying at women's clinics. And I highly recommend you take a look at it. 80% of the abortions in this country are provided by independent providers, and the Abortion Care Network is an organization of us, you know, little mom-and-pop clinics all over the country. And Dr. Tiller was one of the founding members of the Abortion Care Network.
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen up.
The story is about hypocritical social conservatives who want to control your sex life but can't keep it in their pants are coming out so routinely lately that it seems almost pointless to cover them. But I'm going to do a segment on Governor Mark Sanford, in no small part because Senator John Ensign owes Sanford a thank you for upstaging him and his less dramatic affair. Sanford is really playing up the drama that has exploded in the wake of him running off to visit his mistress in Argentina without telling anyone where he was.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with a, which started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do, in just a casual email back and forth, in advice on one's life there and advice here. But here, recently, over this last year, it developed into something much more.
Mark Sanford, as he believes that gays don't deserve the right to love and women don't deserve the right to privacy, has forsaken his right to have either respected for himself. But even so, it was hard to watch the feeding frenzy explode, because it resulted in the exposure of his love letters to his mistress, and has put her on the spot. The few pictures available of her being floated around, probably in no small part because Sanford relished describing her beauty in emails, and that makes people want to see that beauty for themselves. The saddest part of all this is that I doubt that being the object of such a massive exposure and having his love life become an object of ridicule for Sanford probably won't do a thing to convince him to be kinder to women or gays. Of course, what it has done has given other hypocrites an opportunity to act self-righteous, their favorite thing to do. Bill O'Reilly loves playing the martyr over this.
Sanford has admitted to an affair and is likely done in the political world. As soon as I heard the news, I knew someone on the left would celebrate because the governor is a conservative Republican. Now, we all know that some on the right exploited the Monica Lewinsky situation. So reveling in the pain of others is not limited to one ideology. But the far left has been especially vicious lately. And so Governor Sanford's young sons and his wife will bear the brunt of that.
I like how he tries to pass off the impeachment of a president over a blowjob as if it was the actions of a minor fringe. But let's make this clear to O'Reilly and everyone else who wants to play the victim over this. The supposed hard left are the people out there who actually believe in and respect people's right to a private love life. We support gay rights and reproductive rights. If you don't think people have these rights, and Mark Sanford doesn't, then you invite this sort of nonsense. Also, if you tout patriarchal marriage as the end-all be-all, as conservatives like Sanford do, then you're basically asking for the kid to say that the emperor has no clothes. Today, I'll be that kid.
Governor Sanford, obviously, you know, heavily under fire in the state so far, has admitted to having dalliances.
More.
Is that
says,
what the...
He says he crossed the line.
Crossed the line, right. Carefully
but there was no sex.
With six more women, I believe it was, besides his mistress, well, and of course not counting his wife.
Boy, sounds like his marriage must have been boring and miserable that he was flirting with and carrying on at least emotional affairs with six and maybe more women. That doesn't do much for recommending the home life. What's that again about how traditional marriage is so great that we have to build our laws around pushing people into it? And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, the Black President Made Me Do It edition. Here's Rush Limbaugh speculating on why Mark Sanford had an affair.
This Sanford business, I've got to tell you, one of the first thoughts that crossed my mind. This is almost like, I don't give a damn. Country's going to hell in a handbasket, I just want out of here. He had just tried to fight the stimulus money coming to South Carolina. He didn't want any part of it. He lost the battle. He said, what the hell? I mean, the federal government's taken over. What the hell? I want to enjoy life.
There are many reasons this is a stupid thing to think. But let's go for the most obvious, which is the affair actually started before Obama was elected. And it's rumored that it was the reason that McCain picked Sarah Palin instead of Mark Sanford for a running mate.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.